Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
How you doing? And welcome to the show. This week we discuss the aftermath of the Norway bombing and shooting with psychologist Dr. Frank Farley. Dr. Farley has insight into the attacks because he's read Anders Breivik's 1,500-page manifesto. We then switch gears and chat with actress Marissa Ramirez on the new Lifetime series called Against the Wall, where she plays Detective Lena Flores. We also have some very funny comedy from Natasha Leggero and Kathleen Madigan, and we wrap things up with a very cool remix from Adele.
Capture your need for sound.
A horrible crime story that has gripped our attention recently has been the deadly shooting and bombing in Norway that has left over 75 people dead. It seems the sole person responsible for this massacre is in custody, Anders Breivik, who admits to the bombing in Oslo, as well as the carnage at the Utøya youth camp. Why someone would do this is incomprehensible, but to try and help us sort through the pieces is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Farley, thank you again for joining us on the show.
Delighted to be back.
First of all, Dr. Farley, can you give us a brief rundown, I guess, of the day of the massacre? Where did Breivik start the chaos?
Well, he started it in Oslo when he bombed a government building, and it happens to be a building in which the prime minister is often located. He luckily wasn't there at that time. And so he then left and went to an island only, apparently, about 20 minutes away. And went to this island, heavily armed, dressed like a police officer, and started killing people. That's how it went. He actually, and you know, I really have to blame the security forces. There really is no way around it. He was there for almost an hour and a half. Now, in what modern, you know, country in the era of terrorism will allow somebody to kill people for an hour and a half and do nothing? And it's not as if he was on an island in the middle of the ocean. He wasn't. He was very close by, you know, line of sight from the land, for gosh sakes, and boaters all over the place fishing and doing different things. And for an hour and a half, he killed people. And the police never arrived until almost 2 hours. And the police have been saying, oh, you know, they did the right thing, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, Norway really has to get into the 21st century where it comes to terrorism. You know, the helicopter was invented many decades ago. It could have been there in 5 minutes. And they sent their police by land and then by boats. And, you know, it's just a tragedy. So, like all tragedies, there's a lot to learn, and certainly rapid response is one of those things that they need to learn.
And from all of the news reports that continue to surface from Norway, at this point, what is your take on his motivation behind the bombing and the killings?
Well, I read his manifesto, 1,500 pages.
Oh, my goodness.
It's astounding. It took me all one night. I read it, and finally, I didn't read every word, of course, but I read enough, I feel, to get a gist. By 4:30 in the morning, I sort of got to the end of it. It's an astounding piece. I would suggest that, you know, people read it who are interested in this kind of thing. We don't know for sure whether it was entirely written by him. He probably plagiarized some of it from different sources. But one thing that comes through clearly is he hates all sorts of things. This is a man just eaten up with hate. He hates Muslims. He believes that Islam is colonizing Europe, and it's doing it in subtle ways through immigration and through the failure of sort of white Europe to stop this, white Christian Europe to stop this, and diversity, the emphasis on diversity. And so he attacks universities. He attacks affirmative action. And with affirmative action, he says, what you do is you advance the weakest people into positions of power through affirmative action. obviously a racist viewpoint. He attacks feminism. He basically, in a nutshell, he would like to turn the clock back maybe to the 1950s and to an era when white males were the bosses, where white males were in the driver's seat. And he sees what's happening in Europe with multiculturalism, with the rise of Islam, with more porous borders, with a lot of non-white Europeans emigrating into European countries, with egalitarianism, with equal rights for women and for all groups. He sees that as like Armageddon. And he, and he says a handful of others, are going to revive the Knights Templar, these knights of a few hundred years ago. He's reviving that. He calls himself a Knight Templar, and that they are going to rise up and take over Europe and come to power. He says it will take a while. In fact, in one point in his 1,500 pages, he says it could be 100 years, but we've got to start now, and martyrdom will be necessary for some, and including himself. And he expects to be martyred. In fact, he expected to be killed in this lead volley. This is like the lead off for the retaking of Europe, in his view. And that in his manifesto, he calls repeatedly for people to distribute it widely, because he doesn't have the resources to do so, and to join the revolution. And that, in a sense, he's kicking it off with this Norway situation. And that martyrdom will be part of it, and he fully expected to be martyred, and that it is a sort of one-way battle. It's them or it's us.
Did he mention anywhere in that manifesto, Dr. Farley, about sympathizing with the Nazis and all that sort of stuff? Because I feel like that fits right in with all of that.
It does seem to fit in with that. I didn't see that, but again, I couldn't read every word, you know. It's possible that he might... he certainly hated communism. He often uses the word cultural Marxism, and it's difficult to pin down exactly what he means by that. And by the way, it's very densely written, and he goes all over the place. I mean, he pulls in references from here or there, and you really don't know if a lot of the references are accurate or not. But he says that Marxism, in economic Marxism, the idea was to turn all power over to the proletariat, to the people. And so, you know, the brightest people, the elite people, would be driven out of power, and the ordinary people would have the power. And in cultural Marxism, he says it's basically culture. This would happen with culture, and that the ordinary people, everyday people, laborers and so on, would take over. And he doesn't like that. He's an elitist. And it's not clear what the elite is, but it certainly has something to do with white males.
Okay.
And old values of Europe. And it's kind of all over the map, and I think his head is all over the map. But one unifying theme is revolution and his opposition to a full range of developments of the modern world. Political correctness, my gosh, he really goes after that. And he says, for example, pretty soon the government will control everything that you do. You can't smoke over here, you can't smoke over there, you can't do this, you can't do that. Everyone is being dumbed down into the lowest common denominator. People don't think, they just watch mindless television, and the whole world is going to hell because of all of this. And the knights of old, have to arise and save the modern world. He is a leader in that, he sees.
Okay, and if we sort of, I guess, look at all these different pieces, like to put a blanket statement on him, is he insane? Like, what's going on with him? And I guess my second part of that question is, does he fall into then some sort of mass murderer type of category? Like, how does that work too?
Well, I don't know if he's insane or not. You know, you can't tell from writings too easily. I mean, you can see a lot of delusional stuff in here. And, you know, this idea that he is a knight, a modern knight, and he and a small group are going to sort of turn the whole world around. And all of that sounds delusional. But I don't know for sure. You know, it'll take a good psychologist working with him to get closer to answering your question. I don't know if he falls into a mass murderer category. One of the things that we know about profiling serial killers and mass murderers is there are a lot of differences among them. You know, the most frequent, one of the most frequent categories is they tend to be young males. Okay, he fits that category. But it's not clear he fits other categories. He has some similarities to Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, who was very anti-government. And Timothy McVeigh arrived at that. He initially wasn't. And he went into the U.S. military voluntarily and fought in Iraq. But he saw in his Iraqi experience, he saw an imperial America that he didn't like, a sort of country that killed innocent people. And that began gnawing away at him, and he didn't like it. When he came back to the United States, he began, you know, thinking more about those kinds of things, and he began seeing more of what he thought was a government that was not right, that was not good for the people, and so on. And so he began to develop some very deep anti-authority qualities, and ultimately this led to the bombing in Oklahoma City, where an awful lot of people died. And he was executed for that. Well, the Norwegian guy shows some of those qualities, Breivik. The anti-government, the anti-authority, the a lot of the things that are characteristic of the modern world, egalitarianism, political correctness, things I've already mentioned. He really has an incredibly long list of things that he's opposed to. And so he does bear some similarities. He calls himself a revolutionary. And I'll tell you the truth, in reading his document, it's a scary document for a lot of reasons. I mean, for one thing, what it shows about him and what he ultimately did. But it also could resonate with quite a few people. And that's the scary part. You know, he has pleaded not guilty so that he will go on trial. If he pleaded guilty, you know, formally pleaded guilty, there would probably be no trial. But pleading not guilty means he's going to be on trial and he will have a platform for his views. And I don't think he's alone that some people are worried about, you know, radical Islam. Some people are upset about the whole egalitarianism of the modern world. Some are anti-feminist, some are racist. He could be a lightning rod for a lot of those people. And if they get into his manifesto, my gosh, the ammunition in there for their cause is everywhere. And he's brought attention to it by what he did. So I don't see him as just some lone, crazy person, and that'll be the end of it. And we will just all shake our heads and say, wow, you know, there are some really nutty people walking among us. I think that he can have an impact on people who are leaning in his direction.
So you think there could be like a copycat crime in the near future or just down the line?
It could be. It could be. And it could foment groups who see what he's doing. Remember, it doesn't take many people to bring on a revolution. Now, I'm not saying that he is capable of that from what he has written and what he has done. Most people in the world find what he has done absolutely horrendously horrific and heinous and evil and ugly. But there are some people who, if they read his manifesto, might say, boy, these are strong points. You know, back in the day when white men ruled, you know, things were so much better. And now we've got nothing but contending groups, and the government is trying to take over our lives, and our big cities are filthy and dirty and noisy, and crime is a way up, and divorce is everywhere, and our kids are drugged out, and dropping out. And you can just see, these are all the points he makes. And you could see somebody reading it and saying, whoa, he's on to something. And then they might say, so what's this thing about the Templar, like a new revolutionary group of some sort? And so he may be sort of planting a seed with some people that can lead to a lot more trouble than we already have at this minute.
Joining us on the program right now is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Your last point brings me to my next point, Dr. Farley. Do you think he was working alone? Do you think there's others that are actually actively out there waiting for a cue from him, or just this is part of something bigger?
He alleges that he's not working alone in his manifesto. He talked about how, I think it was in 2000 and either 2001 or 2002, he and a small group, he says it numbered up to 12 people, but only about 5 or 6 showed up for this particular meeting, which was this kind of strategy meeting, planning meeting for these Knights of the Templar. And he says that that will sort of emanate out and more people will be brought in. There's no concrete evidence. There's no concrete evidence that such a meeting ever took place. That's not a lot of people, of course. But I have a hunch that he might have one or, you know, a very small group of people that he has been involved with. However, it is interesting. He had friends, and he talks about them, and he names them in his manifesto. But he doesn't, his friends, like from high school days and so on, he will socialize with them. But repeatedly, he says, he tells them nothing of what he is planning and what he is plotting because he doesn't trust that the word might not get out and would prevent him from doing the heinous things he planned to do. So he sounds like a loner. He talks about this meeting that he had, but most of the rest of the time, he sounds very much like a loner plotting a horrendous act. He doesn't date very much. He talks in passing occasionally about some dates he had with women. But most of the time he says he doesn't have time for that because he's got this larger, this grand challenge that he's working on. The operation, as he calls it, the martyrdom operation. He sometimes uses those two words, the martyrdom operation. And therefore, he can't really socialize very much. He would worry about getting drunk or something and letting it out and telling someone about it. So he seems to have this kind of very private life, very little contact with his family. I think his grandfather is somebody he relates to, but not his father. And apparently his sister, he has a sister in Los Angeles, and he might have another sibling, but very little interaction going on there that you can detect. So basically, he kind of comes through as a loner, a revolutionary, a conservative revolutionary, a right-wing revolutionary, working mostly on his own and plotting this whole thing, which he feels will have an enormous impact on the world.
Do you think any of this behavior stems from his childhood? Like, I'm sure you've read tons of things on him. Have you figured out if something was an inciting factor to the way he is now?
I don't know. He actually isn't very revelatory about his childhood. He doesn't tell a lot about it that would a psychologist could grasp onto. And one must remember, too, that he's telling the story. You know, we're not getting that from other people, by and large, who knew him. So I didn't see a lot in his childhood that would have led him to where he is. It's the same. Oh, by the way, I'm wrong when I said something about his grandfather. No, I don't know anything about whether he had a relationship with his grandfather. I don't think so. I don't recall that. That was Timothy McVeigh.
Okay.
Who also had problems with his family.
Oh, I see.
And so there's a connection there. And Timothy McVeigh, it seemed like about the only friend he had that he admired was his grandfather. And in Breivik's case, it's really not clear who was a role model, who he admired, who had a big impact on him as a kid. Some of the impact for him was what he read, reading philosophical works, and even psychologists. He cites several psychologists in there. and he was opposed to what they were saying. But he views the rise of people like Sigmund Freud and so on as destructive. And so he was seems to have been heavily influenced by ideas. Tell you the truth, he seems, without knowing any more, he seems to me to be a person who lives most of his life between his ears, in his head, and not out there in the real world, you know, in contact with reality out there.
And with regards to, I guess, the upcoming trial, because he has now pleaded not guilty, I mean, he, from what I understand, fully admitted that he did the killings, did the bombing. How does he have the right to all of a sudden switch to not guilty, or does he just have that right anyway, and now is this another platform for him to try to get the word out?
Well, it's clearly another platform, and I don't know how that works. I really don't. I don't know how the criminal justice system allows that, honestly. It would seem to me that the thing they want to do the most is to not give him another platform. On the other hand, you know, there may be some people who feel that would serve justice to bring it all out in the open and let people look at how horrific it was. And I don't know about the families of the victims. I don't know how they feel about it. I haven't seen their opinion on.
They're probably all still in shock, right, Dr. Farley? Like, they're probably all still just in complete shock about all of this, the families.
I would think so, absolutely. But I would also think, do they want this dragged out? I would think no.
Okay. And, you know, with regards to, I guess, his defense, I'm assuming they may use the insanity defense if that applies to their court system over there. But do you think, you know, should all of this not work out, which I don't think it will, and he will be sent to prison, do you think there's a very good chance that he will be, I guess, taken care of in prison, for lack of a better word?
Oh, yes. Okay. Oh, yes. I mean, if I was a betting person, I would bet totally on that. Somebody will whack this guy. I mean, his crime is too heinous. It's against innocent children, and that's particularly heinous. Somebody will get to him. That often happens. You know, Jeffrey Dahmer, he was in a prison only 30 miles from where I was living back in Wisconsin when I was a professor there. And it didn't take very long for one of the other prisoners to kill him. And he killed young people, and he ate them, and his fridge was full of body parts and so on. And he went into prison and they got him.
Okay. So that's all, only probably a matter of time. And then,
absolutely.
And then back to, I guess, the martyr thing for just a sec. As you mentioned earlier, he obviously views himself as a martyr. I guess this could be full fold to people that you said may take up his cause, that he will become a martyr to other people as well.
Yes.
Which is a sad thing. And I guess something else I wanted to sort of put forth, again, we focused a lot on what he's done, and again, the awfulness of it. The people that have been affected by it, the people of Norway and Oslo specifically, and then again, those the family members and the victims themselves at the youth camp, how do they move forward, Dr. Farley? Because, I mean, this is nothing that I think in their wildest and most horrible nightmares would have ever happened to them.
Well, there'll probably be a lot of variety among the different families in how they handle it. I hope that if it interferes seriously with their life, they will see a psychologist. Psychologists can help them enormously. Well, it's just stress, depression, anxiety, not being able to get it out of your memory, out of your mind, sleepless nights. It's going to be awful. It really is. I can't imagine losing a child. It's horrific. And under these conditions, it's even worse than unimaginable. So it, you know, there'll be some solace in sharing. I would assume that these people will come together and share their grief and spend time with each other. You know, the idea we're all in this together. We're all in the same boat. And
it's almost like they've got their own, because I remember interviewing a few months back the mother of a 9/11 victim, and she said that she's part of a family that she didn't want to become part of, but she's glad she has them.
Oh, yes, yes. It's one of the profound things about us humans. We are social animals. We're social, very social. We're not solitary animals, most of us. And therefore, sharing, communitarian, you know, talking about it is so important. It's very hard to take, you know, to deal with it on your own.
And I guess a final thought then, Dr. Farley, if you were speaking to the family members of the victims, just because, this is such an awful thing and they are going to go through so many ups and downs, what do you tell them specifically as they move through the stages of grief?
Well, you'll get through it, but you will never forget. And you probably shouldn't ever forget, of course. These are your loved ones. And I think a very important thought is that the child or children that you lost would not want you to be another victim of this terrorism. They would not want you to ruin your life through grief. They would want you to move on and live the best possible life that you can and do good and love all of the members of your family and other loved ones and the friends of the child you lost. But they would not want you to destroy your life because of this dreadful, dreadful event.
Dr. Farley, thank you again for joining us this week on the show. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Again, that's Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
As you know, we like to have a lot of fun here on The Kelly Alexander Show, and one of our favorite ways of doing that is presenting some amazing comedians. And right now, I'd like to present to you two female comedians, one that I saw recently at the Nasty Girls Night Out at the Just for Laughs Festival here in Montreal. She's also been a part of Last Comic Standing. She's amazing, Natasha Leggero. And then after that, I've told you before how much I love this lady, Kathleen Madigan. So get ready to laugh with these two ladies on The Kelly Alexander Show.
What is happening with customer service? I saw some girl's brain stop the other day. Have you seen this? She's ringing me up and she's like... And then I'm waiting in line to pay behind this mother-daughter cowgirl team and they don't have enough money, so they decide they have to put something back. So the mom's like, you put your book back. Can I put my book back? You put your book back. Why should I put my book back? You put your book back. So finally, I'm like, ladies, I wanted to help them. I was like, ladies, In Touch Weekly is not a book. And then it's my turn to pay, right? And the woman's like, debit or credit. And as I'm signing, I feel this sharp thing hit me in the head. The woman behind the register is clipping her fingernails. I got so mad, I grabbed my stuff, and as I go out, she's like, have a blessed day. But see, I knew, even in her head, she misspelled the word blessed. You guys have babies? You have babies? My friends who have babies can't do anything. You can't go out. Like, having a baby is like a DUI from the universe. I'm trying to think of why everyone's getting so dumb. I think it's the reality television, right? Like, they're making these... They're making these shows so dumb, and, like, they're trying to hide the fact that they haven't hired actors, there's no jokes, no writers, so they just make the rules confusing. It's like, tonight, the bottom two decide which six will join the final five. My favorite show, though, is American Idol, because I just love these girls who are auditioning at the beginning. I think I'm gonna be the next American Idol. In fact, I know I am. You have a lazy eye. Every girl. Hi, my name is Cardinal and I'm from Hinsville. But get ready, America, because I want to sing you a song.
Oh, man. Sun grace how sweet.
Whose idea was it for everybody to start singing like that? You're white. Well, this has been great fun. I know it's hard to listen to women sometimes, but male comics are always coming up to me and they're like, hey, Natasha, don't you think you're a little attractive to be a comedian? And I'm like, don't you think you're a little ugly to be talking to me? Thank you.
And here is the very talented Kathleen Madigan.
God love the Canadians. I love that country. Are there any Canadians in here tonight? Clap. Not one? That is so odd. There's the one. They're always so polite. They don't clap till the second time. Then they're like, all right, okay, I'm here. All right. It's a lovely country. To us, it's like our attic. You forget it's up there, but then when you get up there, you're like, wow, look at all this crap. And I totally forgot this is up here. Do not use your cell phone if you go there, though, because it's a total trick. Like, it won't say Rome. It looks totally normal. So I just dialed for a week at this comedy festival thing. I get home. I get a bill for, like, $8 million. And not only can AT&T be mean, they can be very condescending. The lady was like, well, ma'am, Canada is another country. I was like, not really. I could see Detroit and their animals looked exactly like ours. The good thing was this time I went, their money was worth half of ours, and I'm so bad at math, like I cannot do that translation stuff. I was like, oh, perfect, half. I can totally handle that. Well, then I went shopping, and I saw shoes that were 50% off. I'm like, well, then they're free. See, you guys followed my logic. I don't know why American Express can't seem to, it's still a pending investigation. I'm like, well, get a pencil, dumbass. 50 minus 50 is nothing. Like, sometimes there is good stories on the news, though. Like, I saw a whole story on CNN, I'm not making this up, about a guy who woke up out of a 19-year coma. I know, I was like, wow, what a miracle. His family did not turn him off. Are you kidding me? My family? No. My family put up with that situation for a week and a half. And then they start complaining about whose turn it was to visit me. Well, she's not even paying attention. It's stupid. I'm sure they'll call if she wakes up. I mean, duh.
I am thrilled to introduce you to my next guest. She's a wonderful actress who's made her mark on daytime television, on The Bold and the Beautiful, The Young and the Restless, and General Hospital. And during her time on General Hospital, she was nominated for both ALMA and NAACP awards. She's also been a part of the thrilling show Spartacus, God of the Arena, and now she embarks on a brand new adventure, the Lifetime series Against the Wall, playing police detective Lena Flores. Marissa Ramirez, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you. Thanks, Kelly.
Marissa, I guess I have to start off by asking you, have you been acting your whole life?
Definitely with my family in front of the mirror, but it wasn't really something that I wanted to get into when I was younger. I started modeling when I was 12, and then after high school, I sort of left the country and traveled around doing the modeling stuff for a couple of years, and then I sort of realized that that wasn't really fulfilling me anymore, and I got home, got into an acting class, and it just sort of went from there. And it's been a nice ride. I've been very lucky, and it's keeping me very happy, and I've been pretty blessed.
And what was your first professional acting gig?
I think I was doing a guest spot on one of those Saturday morning television shows, like USA High, one of those sort of things that I, sort of grew up watching. And that was my first job. And then I went from there and I started hosting for MTV. I was hosting a stunt show and I did some other stuff on the channel. And that was a lot of fun. And I got to sort of be myself and have a bit of personality rather than sort of playing a character. And then I went straight from that to General Hospital. So.
And I can't wait to ask you about your time in soaps, because I think that's actually a very important learning ground, I think, for a lot of actors. But something I wanted to ask you, not only as a young actor, but I guess also as a young woman, there's so many kids out there, whether they are female or male, that want to get into the entertainment industry and, want to go through acting or through, being a part of a band or a solo artist. What do you say to them with regards to rejection? Because we always hear, how difficult the audition process is and what life in, whether it's LA or New York, is like. Can you maybe shed a bit of experience, like what it was like for you to go through auditions and maybe even what it's still like to go through that, and what advice you would give to young people about how to stay, I guess, solid with themselves and true to themselves?
Well, I think a lot of people move to LA or New York or come into new cities with stars in their eyes, and they just see the glamour and, the movie-making aspect of the industry and how it's all, fame and glory. And really, there is so much rejection and hard times and stress that come along with it. And you have to have a very strong backbone and be very self-assured and very strong in beliefs as to who you are and very confident with yourself, because sometimes those comments, a casting director will throw out a comment that can just throw you. And if some people are not strong enough to handle something like that, it can just kill you and basically get into your head and mess up everything. And so I think basically people just need to come from a very strong core and just work on that, just work on themselves, just work on being just very strong and confident and confident in their talents is one thing. Because if you know you're talented and somebody doesn't give you a job and then you don't get the next job when you pound on that door, just knowing that you're talented enough to get through the next door on your own will take you that step further.
And a question, I guess, as well, because, you know, you mentioned that you had done some of those shows, like the Saturday morning shows. Obviously, you've been around, I guess, child actors a fair amount. What do you say, or what's your, I guess, thought process on, you know, whether it's a kid that they themselves really want to be, you know, acting, as opposed to a kid that's sort of being forced to do it by their parents who are perhaps, you know, trying to live vicariously through their kids?
Oh, that's so hard to see. And I've seen that so much with, you know, stage moms. And I personally would never, if I had a child, I would never get them in the industry when they're young. It's a decision that I feel like a child needs to make on their own after they've grown up and sort of had these childhood experiences, because I see so many kids being schooled on sets and not having, you know, the friends that are outside of the industry that sort of go on to have normal lives. And you know, those childhood experiences make us who we are now and who we are today. And I think without that, you just become a product of the entertainment industry, and you're kind of always searching, I think, anyways. So it is very difficult to see. I think kids need to sort of make those own decisions themselves. I know, like, toddlers and tiaras, that sort of thing. It's so hard for me to watch that. So hard.
I think that's a very valid point. I cannot watch it either. It was on the other night and I turned the channel because I can't watch
it.
It's too much. Yeah. It's too much, especially with all the hair gel going on and the hairspray. Joining us on the show right now is actress Marissa Ramirez, who's on the brand new show Against the Wall on Lifetime. Now, Marissa, I do have to talk to you about Daytime. What was it like getting cast on such a well-known and, you know, a tradition? I think General Hospital is a tradition for many people.
You know, it's one of those shows that's been around for so many years, and soaps are so important because they come into people's homes every single day, and I think viewers feel like they're a part of the cast because they're seeing these people every day on TV, and they feel like they're a part of their lives and their storylines. And I personally didn't grow up watching soaps, so I really had no idea how big General Hospital was and what a, you know, huge impact it would sort of have on my career as sort of starting me off and given being such a good training ground for me. But, you know, it was such a good experience and I had a blast, and the people on set were amazing. The crew, the cast, amazing. And it was such a good first, you know, contract role, first big job for me. And it is sort of paved the ground for me in work now, in that when you're working on a soap, you sometimes have 13 scenes a day or something crazy with pages and pages to memorize. So when you're on a primetime series show, it doesn't seem as hard. It's not as difficult because you have like maybe 5 or 6 scenes and it's not a lot of dialogue. So soaps are important to keep around. Soaps are important for actors to get their first breaks and good training grounds. And I just hope they stay around forever. I'm sad to see some of them go.
I'm so glad you brought up the fact about, you know, the fact that it trains you and it teaches you so many important things before you get into the primetime shows, because I find that, you know, a lot of people seem to poo-poo daytime as if like it's not real acting and it's all contrived and everything. But I'm so glad that you brought out the example that it is a lot of work and there are pages and pages of dialogue and you don't have the luxury of spending 3 days on a scene. Like, you have to get it done. And, you know, you just mentioned that, you know, some soaps are on their way out. I know, we've had a bunch of cancellations in the last couple of years. Guiding Light was gone the last year. Now, you know, All My Children and One Life to Live. But a lot of the actors that were on those shows, I know they're going to move potentially or hopefully to being web series. What do you feel about your fellow actors who decided to come back to say goodbye properly, like Josh Duhamel, who has decided to come back to All My Children to say a sort of a proper goodbye? I know Kelly Ripa is still a big fan of being on All My Children. Do you appreciate that actors are proud of where they come from?
I do. I think it's very important. I you know, it's almost like the soaps were my family. If I turned my nose up to them as soon as I left, what kind of a person would that make me? And you know, just it's wonderful that Josh and Kelly are paying their respects and they're, because they know that they've paid their dues by working so hard on those soaps to get where they are now. And I didn't know they were going back. That's awesome.
Yeah, I know that. I know Kelly was sort of still in talks, as far as I understand, but I know Josh was definitely supposed to be going back, as is Eva LaRue from CSI Miami. She actually, I was fortunate to interview her a few months ago, and she told me that she desperately wanted to go back to pay homage to All My Children because of the fact that she said that she grew up on that show. Like, she became an adult on that show, and she went through so many life experiences that's so close to her that she wanted to do whatever she could to sort of say a proper goodbye at that time, which I thought was great. And I just think
it's
great.
And
I wanted to ask you too now, like, the difference, you sort of mentioned it briefly about the fact that on a daytime soap, you have so many pages of dialogue to get through. Was it a difficult transition to go from daytime to primetime, or was it seamless because you'd already done the hard part first, if I can put it that way?
It's tough because I never really noticed too much of a difference, and it just sort of like I was taking the next step and just going with the flow, and I think maybe a lot of times I was just quiet because I'm absorbing everything that's happening around me and trying to learn as much as possible so I don't seem completely green to it, but it wasn't a tough transition at all. I remember my first series I was working two jobs. I would go to General Hospital in the morning, and then I would go shoot the series in the afternoon, and that was actually the best time of my life. It's great.
That's fantastic. And I'm very excited to talk to you about this new show, Against the Wall. Can you sort of, you know, tell us about it and tell us how you became a part of the project?
Against the Wall is a new series for the Lifetime Network, and it is centered around a family of cops who the lead decided she wanted to become a homicide detective, but the only opening is in internal affairs. And I play her partner, who is very pregnant and very hormonal and has a lot of attitude and thinks it's hilarious that this, her new, you know, my new partner, played by Rachel Carbone, is so sort of new to internal affairs, and her family is just on her butt as far as, that's not what you do when you come from a family of cops. You don't join IA because we're known as the Rat Squad. But this show is awesome, and in that it's different from other cop dramas and procedurals that are out there because there's heart, and, you know, there are moments where you laugh because of Abby's just very different personality, and there are moments where you cry because of the family issues going on, and it's different. It's a lot of fun to watch. It's definitely a joy to work on. I actually was in New Zealand working on Spartacus when I had to put myself on tape for the audition and send it back up to the States. And a couple of days after I returned from New Zealand, I was testing for this role. And we shot the pilot in November in Toronto, and it got picked up in the end of January, beginning of February. And so we've been in Toronto since the middle of April, working on the 13 episodes, and we're almost done.
And what do you like, or how does it feel, I guess, is the question, taping in Toronto as opposed to taping in the States or Los Angeles, New York specifically?
Well, the show is supposed to take place in Chicago. So Toronto has that vibe where it can kind of look like any major city, New York, or, you know, so it's, I think that's why a lot of shows shoot here. And I just love traveling, and I love being in a different city and learning my way around and finding different places to go. And shooting in LA, because I live there, I'm from there, my family's there. So when I get off of work, I go to my gym, or I go see my friends, or I go see my grandma or something. But here, it brings us all closer because a lot of us aren't from here. So the cast has become very friendly and almost like a family because we're away from home with each other. So it actually brings that sort of element to the show and to our chemistry on screen, being that we're so close off camera, we're close on camera as well. And it just makes it easiest for us to sort of work together and gauge each other's personalities every day.
I was watching the previews of the show on television the last couple of weeks as they were promoing, you know, for the first night of it. And you know, sometimes you get a sense that a show's going to go, and I don't want to jinx you or anything, but I feel like the show's going to, I'm going to say it so you're not saying it, but I feel like it's going to go, especially because you have such a well-rounded cast. And I would like if you could just talk a little bit about some of your cast members, because I think a lot of people will be excited to hear that, you know, Kathy Baker from Picket Fences is on there. Treat Williams is in there. What's it like working with these actors who've been around the block for a long time?
when we work together, when we see each other out, when we go to dinner with each other, it's more about getting to know each other as human beings. And it's not really about, well, what have you done? And what's on your resume kind of thing? And who have you worked with? I mean, of course, Treat Williams has some amazing stories about his past and jobs that he's been on. And so it's always fun to be around him and to listen to him. And he's sort of like, you know, the dad of the show and of all of us. And Kathy is just a sweetheart. We actually live pretty close to each other in LA, and she's just normal, down to earth, just amazing, sweet woman. And Rachel is from Australia, and we get along like we've known each other for years. And I laugh when I'm working with her. I laugh the hardest than I feel like I've laughed in the past 10 years. I've just been laughing so much. My stomach muscles are always killing me. We all just have such a good time together. And then, of course, we have the three brothers who are played by Brandon Quinn, who was just on Entourage, and two locals, Steve Byers and James Thomas. And then there's a couple other hot guys on this show. We have Andrew Walker and Chris Johnson. And we're just, you know, we have a lot of fun together. And my husband, actually, on this show is played by Jason George, who was just recently on Off the Map.
Okay.
I think he's a soap veteran too. I forget which soap, but he's been around.
So you guys definitely have formed this bond by probably being away from LA.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Fun.
And you know, I want to ask you too, I know you're sort of, I guess, I mean, if you're almost finished taping the 13 episodes, I guess you're getting obviously a good grasp on your character and where's it going. How do you feel about her? Like how does, Marissa feel about Lena?
Well, what's funny is that my character is going through the whole first season pregnant. So my belly is growing. I'm wearing this huge prosthetic and it's heavy. And so my character's eating all the time, eating hot dogs and having odd cravings, which is so much fun for me to play. Of course, I just came from being naked on Spartacus. So it's kind of a blessing that I get to wear clothes. But I'm nervous about, well, if we do come back for a second season and I don't have the baby, what am I going to be doing? Because I'm so used to having these different mannerisms when I wear the belly that are just so different from what I've ever done on any other job in the past. So it's fun. It's fun to have something to work with and have something to play with. And I don't think I've ever had that before.
That's amazing. And I have to ask you too, you know, being an actress in this day and age, and whether you're an actress or, you know, a recording star, I feel like so many people in the entertainment industry have really embraced Twitter and or Facebook. I have to ask you, are you a big Twitter fan? And do you feel like you're more connected to your fans that way?
I don't do Twitter. I don't really do any of it. It's not really me. You know, I just feel like, Why would anybody care what I'm doing right now? Like all day long, I'm going to talk about myself. That just doesn't feel fun. It doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel genuine. It doesn't feel like it's coming from a good place. It feels like it's almost narcissistic, and it's just not me. So, so I'm just not into it.
Well, that's great. I think that's great. I think it's very refreshing when I do talk to someone who isn't involved in it. Because, for example, you know, myself, I have two Twitter accounts and two Facebook accounts because there's like the private
Sorry,
life.
I hope I didn't offend you.
No, not at all. Not at all. Like, I mean, I think I would embrace, I think I really do like Facebook. Like I have to say, I do like Facebook. I don't know necessarily that I would go after Twitter as much, but just because of the job that I do, being in radio, it's sort of a necessity to sort of stay in contact with our local fans, I guess, if you want to put it that way.
Right.
So, but I think it's refreshing when I meet someone who doesn't want to do that. And even for example, one of my colleagues at the radio station, she does have, you know, the Facebook and the Twitter, but she only recently got a cell phone. Like she's been, she has just shunned cell phones for the last 15 years. And I just find it refreshing to hear people's reasonings why they don't do it. So I think that's great. And I guess I wanted to ask you, just because of the way that the industry is going, with regards to your future, where do you see yourself in the next, you know, 18 months to 2 years? Do you want to make another leap to film? Like, do you want to get more into film, or do you like staying in television, or do you have other aspirations, even maybe with regards to literature?
You know, my thing is I just want to work. I just want to keep working until I'm over it, until I want to do something else, or until I die. I really enjoy what I do, and I'm not very picky about jobs. And, you know, if a great role comes along in a film, I definitely want to do it. And, you know, I'm just going to continue to put myself out there and audition for things that seem great to me. You know, I just want to work. It's just sort of a job to me. I'm not looking to become anything more.
Okay.
And yeah, it's kind of like, it's one of those things where you just kind of just keep going with the flow and see what happens.
That's amazing. I think you have a very healthy attitude. I think more actresses or actors should have, it's almost like you have a step removed from it, which I think probably helps keep you sane.
You know, I think growing up in LA and just being around it since I was a little kid, maybe just did something to me and made me realize that, you know, it's not all that. It's not all about the glamour. It's a job. This is how I pay my rent, you know, and that's, I just have to continue to look at it like that. It's my job.
Okay. And just to sort of end things off then, what advice would you give, again, to aspiring actors or even musicians about following this pursuit, like whether it is acting or music, and how they keep themselves to not get into the trappings of Hollywood?
You know, it's different for everybody. And for me, I would always tell people, you know, get into classes and get into acting classes and read books and get into workshops and get out there and meet people. But some people, like myself, I can't do very many acting classes because then I'm constantly in my head and it doesn't become a natural thing anymore, because acting is kind of all about acting, you know, it's about reacting to other people. And once you forget how to do that, how to interact socially, it's not going to come off as being natural. So it's almost like, you know, tell people to get out there and socialize and enjoy life and try new things and take classes, and not necessarily acting classes, but I mean, you know, take a tennis class, take a horseback riding, just get out there and just keep yourself active, keep yourself going, and keep learning about yourself. Because when you learn about yourself, it seems to bring out more of who you are when you're acting in a role, or it seems to surprise yourself as to, oh, I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know I could act like that. And I don't know. Everybody's different. But the one thing is that in this industry, you have to stay strong, whether you're a musician, whether you're an actor, whether you're a writer, just stay strong and keep going. I think a lot of people give up too soon.
Marissa, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Marissa Ramirez, again, who's on the brand new show Against the Wall on Lifetime. Make sure to check it out.
Bring on the remix.
I heard that you're settled down, that you found a girl and you're married now. Your dreams came true. Guess she gave you things I didn't give to you. Oh, friend, why are you so shy? Ain't like you to hold back or hide from the light. I hate to turn out of the blue, uninvited, but I couldn't stay away. I couldn't fight it. I had hoped you'd see my face and that you'd be reminded that for me it isn't over. Never mind, I'll find someone like you. I wish nothing but the
That's Adele with Someone Like You, the Esquire versus Offbeat remix on The Kelly Alexander Show. Well, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, including the always amazing and very insightful Dr. Frank Farley. Also to actress Marissa Ramirez. Best of luck, Marissa, on your new show, Against the Wall, on Lifetime. Well, that pretty much does it for me this week. I want to leave you with a thoughtful quote from Ivern Ball. Quote, "Most of us can read the writing on the wall. We just assume it's addressed to someone else." End quote. Something to think about, I think. Thank you again for joining us. Again, any comments or questions, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.